We're talking about presidential election ad buys here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Presumptive Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden is outspending President Trump this month with big TV ad spending in battleground states like Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin. That's according to data from Advertising Analytics with number crunching by Axios. We reached out to the political ad trackers at the Wesleyan Media Project for analysis. What do you notice about TV ads and the ones you encounter on digital platforms? Do the ads speak to your concerns as a voter? Do they sway you? Are you prepared for the onslaught of ads after Labor Day? What will you watch for? We're at 800-642-1234. Michael Franz is a professor of government and legal studies at Bowdoin College in Maine, where he researches political advertising, campaign finance, and interest groups. Michael, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
So with the pandemic changing the way campaigns are operating, you've got all of these virtual events. Are media ad buys even more important than before?
Yeah, I think they are. They're particularly important for reaching voters who aren't going to see a lot of big campaign rallies on the news at night. Campaigns need to find voters where they are, and that's right now, and has been for the last number of months, at home. That's changing in lots of places, but that's how campaigns are primarily trying to talk to voters these days.
And so finding them at home, you know, the campaigns know where many of these voters are because there have been so many stay-at-home orders in recent months. Does that change how they go about their advertising?
Yes, I think in some ways the coronavirus issue is changing things specific to 2020 in the sense that campaigns have to find voters at home by going more on TV and doing more digital advertising. But it's also in many ways just accelerating some trends that we've seen over the years, which is that, you know, many people don't watch traditional live television as they used to. Many people still do. But a lot of people, especially younger voters, are getting their media and their news more online. And so you're seeing campaigns transition to more digital-based advertising, advertising on social media platforms, for example. And so this this current pandemic crisis has probably accelerated those trends as opposed to just creating them. And we are seeing campaigns put more ads in more places to try to find voters.
When you say more places, where are those additional places? Social media, of course, we've had an eye on that. The TV in the living room, that it's there. But where are some other places to put these ads?
Yeah, well, I mean, TV has even gotten more diversified because you have live traditional television ads on your local news broadcast, but you can also see in campaigns are doing more things on local cable television. So you might see some advertising on, you know, ESPN or TV networks that traditionally in recent years haven't seen political ads. You're seeing ads on streaming platforms where people may be watching television on Hulu or and other places that support advertising. Campaigns may be going there. Ads are going on to, of course, radio. Ads have been on radio for, you know, 90 years. And you're seeing ads on streaming platforms like streaming radio, websites, social media such as Facebook and search advertising on Google. So it's kind of spreading out and going in all places where voters, citizens are accumulating information.
We're talking with Michael Franz, who researches political advertising, campaign finance, and interest groups. We're looking at the 2020 presidential election, political advertising. What questions do you have about how campaign finance regulations affect ads? Do you support campaign finance reform? Join in at 800-642-1234. Michael, the Wesleyan Media Project looked at nearly 85,000 TV ads about the presidential race from May 11th to the end of June. About 50,000 came from the Trump campaign, about 11,600 from outside groups supporting him. What impact has the Trump campaign's early domination of the airwaves had on the race?
Well, it may not have had much of an effect thus far. If you look at some of the polling, he is pretty far behind in national polling and behind in many battleground states. And those are where Trump is putting those ads. He's putting ads in the places that are likely going to be the most contested states this fall. He's likely trying to basically kind of not fall farther back at the moment. The news around the coronavirus issue has not been beneficial to his campaign. He wants to divert attention away from that issue and on to the issues that advantage him. And so at this moment, I think what he's doing is attempting to stabilize those poll numbers, turn the attention on to Joe Biden and what the Trump campaign believes are the deficiencies in the Biden campaign, and hope that can turn the tide. We haven't seen any real evidence that that's had those effects as of yet, but voters are, obviously paying attention to the campaign, but will be turning their attention to things more earnestly in the coming weeks. And I think the Trump campaign knows that that's the messaging it wants to try to establish for the fall campaign.
Michael, how will mail-in absentee voting and early voting affect media ad buys and when they happen?
That's a great question, because many voters across the country are going to want to vote by mail and vote early. And traditionally, in an old-fashioned presidential campaign, you would see a lot of advertising in the fall and very late in the fall, right up to the end of the campaign on election day. But campaigns know that they have to reach voters earlier. They have to reach them more consistently, and they have to remind them more frequently to cast their ballots. And so I think what you'll see is a lot of TV ads throughout the summer and into the fall, but you will also see a huge investment on advertisements on platforms like Facebook that will try to remind core voters, whether they be Democrats or Republicans, depending on the campaign, to request mail-in ballots, to vote online. Democrats will probably do this much more frequently than Republicans, but it wouldn't surprise me if Republicans reminded voters about early voting deadlines as well, and spending a lot of emphasis on mobilization, not just at the end, but throughout the fall campaign when ballots are available to voters.
You know, we're such fragmented consumers of media. I'm wondering, are people still watching traditional TV?
Yes, well, people definitely are, but the demographic is very different and changing. So one reason why we see traditional television, over-the-air live TV, still important to campaigns is because the folks who watch TV over the air are tend to be older voters. And older voters are very, very consistent people who turn out to vote. They vote on a regular basis, and they can be relied on to turn out to vote. And so in a state like Wisconsin with already high turnout, then reaching older voters in a state that has a political culture that encourages turning out to vote, TV is very, very important. Traditional TV is very important in that sense. Younger voters tend not to watch traditional live television, but watch a lot of streaming television and, of course, accumulate a lot of news online. And so that has led to a fragmentation in the outreach of campaigns, as TV still makes a huge importance in encouraging older voters who regularly turn out to continue to participate. But campaigns need to reach younger voters in new places. And so this has put a lot of emphasis on new media.
We're talking about political ad spending with Bowdoin College government professor Michael Franz, who tracks political ads. What messages resonate with you in the presidential political ads so far? How do attack ads make you feel? Do you pay attention to mudslinging? What do you want to know about ad buys in the battleground states like Wisconsin? Join in at 800-642-1234. We'll be back in a minute with Michael Franz here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're talking about political ad spending and what the fall may look like as voters get bombarded by candidate ads. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Last month, news outlets were reporting on the Trump campaign running a Spanish language TV ad in Florida, Arizona, other battleground states, and nationally. The spot is identical to one in English that claims former Vice President Joe Biden doesn't have the mental fitness for the job.
Joe Biden está deteriorado.
Rapidly rising in with...
Ahora a los 77 años y su tercera candidatura presidencial.
Have you been seeing political ads like this one on TV or online? Do they influence how you vote? Do you verify the messages in political ads? Do you know who paid for the ad? Join in 800-642-1234. Michael Franz is a government and legal studies professor at Bowdoin College, and he stays with us. Let's take a call now. Dave is with us from Richland Center. Hi, Dave.
Hi. I'm 64, so I've been around this political ad stuff since Kennedy, you know, came on TV. It's the big bad wolf and the little red riding hood. One's worse than the other. It's the same template over and over again, like in the news media. Let's vilify this person, but we're going to turn this other person into a saint. Neither candidate is a saint or a bright person. There's so many layers to politics, and people got to understand this. These political ads, to me right now, I just laugh. There's so much Jerry Springer because it's just a game show. I wish they would come up with something a little different, more on the economy. The only thing matters to me, the way I make my living is if the economy is good, I'm good. If the economy's in the toilet, I'm not so good. So it only matters. I don't care Democrat or Republican, but who's going to get things going and make it good for small business or business in general to do business in this and not sell us out to foreign countries.
Dave, thank you for that. You know, Dave is saying, Michael, this is the same template cycle after cycle. Do these ads do anything to sway voters?
Well, that's a really important question. The research on this suggests, amazingly enough, that the effects of political advertising are not very large. Voters come to their decision, especially in presidential elections, with a lot of prior information about the campaigns, and a lot, as the caller suggests, of the on-the-ground assessment of how the country is going. And so campaign ads can't change those dynamics, but they can change things on the margins. And so for all the money that's spent in campaigns on campaign ads, they're really meant to influence the margins in battleground states. And what I mean by that is if polling suggests that the campaign is 50-50, but ads, you know, a $2 million ad buy can only get you a quarter of a point, that might make the difference between winning and losing that state. And that's really all campaign ads are meant to do for campaigns is to shift those marginal voters in small ways enough to tip the balance in your favor.
When ads go negative, do attack ads work?
Well, attack ads can definitely work, but voters, voters, as you know, and as this caller suggested as well, don't like negative ads. And so there is always a risk that voters will punish the sponsor of a vicious attack. And so campaigns generally think of negative ads as being best served to be ones that focus on policy differences. That tends to be what negative ads are. Now, the media and voters focus our energy a lot of the times on the ones that are not policy-focused negative ads. But on balance, negative ads focus on policy differences between campaigns because it's a bit of a tinderbox to attack your opponent on personal characteristics.
We're talking with Michael Franz, co-director of the Wesleyan Media Project, discussing campaign advertising and specifically how ads are being used in the presidential race. Would you support social media companies' ability to regulate campaign ads and political content? How do you think campaign ads affect our elections and our democracy? Join in at 800-642-1234. Michael, can you break down the differences and the influences of outside groups, you know, the super PACs, the carry PACs, the 501c4s? How can you give us a sense on how these outside groups spend their dollars?
Yeah, so the differences amongst groups is a hugely important a difference, primarily in terms of how these groups raise and then have to disclose their spending publicly. At the moment, most of these groups, whether they be super PACs that can raise large donations or 501c4, what we call dark money groups that don't have to disclose their donors. Most of these groups at the moment are spend their dollars on advertising. Increasingly, some of those groups are spending it on digital advertising. So diversifying a bit from just a few cycles ago where it was almost all TV advertising. But not many of these outside groups do the other things that campaigns do, which is on the ground voter mobilization. So before the pandemic hit, you know, a key way of getting people to vote was to knock on their door and ask them to vote, or to give them a call on the phone and ask them to vote, sort of a one-to-one contact. Campaigns are pretty good at doing that with voters that they think need a nudge. Outside groups didn't have the infrastructure to really do that. They had a lot of money. And so what they would do is spend that on television ads and now digital ads. And that's changing a little bit, but primarily they invest most of those resources in the advertising game.
Do you see them cycle after cycle, and do they coordinate at all with each other or go after each other?
Well, sometimes, yes. Yeah. So across the aisle, they definitely go after each other. There are a few groups that have lasted over the course of a number of cycles, such as Priorities USA, which is a pro-democratic super PAC. You see some long-lasting outside groups like the NRA or labor unions, which also have super PAC accounts that have been around for many years. But you also do see cycle after cycle new groups form that are super PACs meant to help particular candidates. And so in 2020, Joe Biden has a super PAC that's supporting him called Unite the Country. That didn't exist before his candidacy. And so campaign or outside groups, they kind of come and go depending on who's running. And there are some that have been around for a long time. In terms of coordination, none of these groups can coordinate with the candidates directly. The campaign finance laws prevent that, but they can coordinate and talk to one another. And sometimes that does happen depending on the types of groups that they are. They can coordinate messages on that side of things. But campaigns, candidates themselves are forced to sort of hope that their supportive outside groups are saying things that that will work in their benefit.
We've been hearing about the Lincoln Project, the group created by 8 former Republican operatives that's been running anti-Trump ads online and on TV. Is the Lincoln Project relatively new, or have you seen this type of project before?
Well, I'd say in an age of polarization, it is fairly new to see an outside group formed by members of a party running ads primarily to damage the standing of a candidate in that party. There was a Never Trump movement in 2016 that didn't really gather much steam. And so this is, a bit more of an attempt to come up with a strategy that might make a difference in 2020. We traditionally don't see outside groups from one party attacking members of their own party because of how polarized the two parties are. But in an age of Donald Trump, that, you know, has obviously upended the rules a bit. And these Republicans are just fed up with, Donald Trump's takeover of the Republican Party. Whether those ads work or not is another question. It's certainly gotten a ton of attention, and that can have an added effect that voters go and look for these ads, and they can matter, beyond just the number of times they air on TV as a result.
I want to take a closer look at digital. Twitter eliminated political ads on its platform. Facebook has started to label political content. How have these moves affected ad buys?
Yeah, so, for campaigns, Twitter was not a huge deal in terms of advertising. Campaigns weren't spending a lot of money on Twitter ads. Facebook ads, however, are the dominant story, and Google ads bought through the Google platform. You might see ads as a result of the searches you do in Google, and you might see ads on the platforms owned by Facebook and Google, such as Instagram and YouTube. Facebook has faced an issue with how to handle the extensive amount of content that political sponsors have put on their platform. And so they've responded by trying to label some of that, make that available for the public to view through a political ad archive. It's a lot to sort through. At the end of the day, a regular voter who's just sort of scrolling through their sponsored news feed or their news feed is going to see these ads mixed in with posts from their friends and high school friends. And those messages may or may not make a huge difference on how people think about campaigns, but there's a lot more of them than there used to be. And that's how campaigns are increasingly trying to reach younger voters and do all sorts of things that they need to do to run campaigns. Remind voters when election day is or when early ballots are available. Remind voters to turn out. Ask voters to donate money and so on.
Michael, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
Michael Franz is a professor of government and legal studies at Bowdoin College in Maine. He's co-director of the Wesleyan Media Project, the predecessor of the Wisconsin Advertising Project. Coming up, Lemon Weir Elementary School in Toma has opened its doors. We check in with the school's principal about the decision and logistics of teaching during a pandemic. That's coming up after this news update here on the Ideas Network. You're with us as we check in with an elementary school principal reopening in the face of the pandemic. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Nationwide, millions of children may need to learn remotely when classes restart this fall. Education leaders, they face a daunting task of delivering education with no end in sight to the pandemic. And for some schools on a year-round schedule, class is in session, in person. Should classrooms reopen this fall? Has your district made a decision on how it will deliver the curriculum? What do you want to know from a school with in-person classes underway? We're at 800-642-1234. Nikki Pope is principal of Lemon Weir Elementary School in Toma. It runs on a year-round schedule, reopened last Wednesday. Nikki, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hello, good morning.
All right, so now that students and teachers are back in school, how are they feeling about being back in the classroom?
Well, our students are certainly excited. You can definitely tell that they've missed the interaction with peers and especially the teaching staff. You know, my staff is equally as excited. They're anxious. You know, everyone's watching. Everyone's anticipating what could happen and how they should move forward. But they're very happy to be here.
How are you approaching mask wearing?
So our district has taken the stance with both children and staff that it is highly recommended. But we are not requiring them to wear a mask at this time.
And so when you go class to class and pop your head in, how many children might be wearing masks?
When I've been looking, I would anticipate on an average class, there's probably about 20%. So throughout the building, that seems to be what I'm seeing. You know, as their friends are wearing masks, more students are asking to wear masks. So if they're asking, we do have a supply here that we are providing one for them. But that was when coming in the first few days, that was about 20% of the students.
Nikki, take us through the steps to reopening the classrooms and to reopening your school. How did you prepare for Wednesday?
Well, you know, our first preparation was really to make sure that that's what our families and our community was looking for. We wanted to have a really good pulse on being responsive to what our families wanted. So I surveyed our families and asked if they had a preference as far as a face-to-face option or if they wanted the virtual option. And the initial survey that went out was around 82% of our families wanted their students in the building. When it came down to it, it was closer to 90% of them that ended up sending their students back. So that was the first step, was to make sure we were not speaking for our families and we were listening to what they wanted. From there, we really just tried to develop the best system to keep our students socially distanced as much as possible. We knew that within transportation and a classroom, that wasn't going to be very feasible to expect 6 feet apart at all times. So we created a cohort type of model where our students that are in the classroom are really around those students throughout the day. They're not intermingling with grade level peers or different classrooms. So that means that they're eating their lunch within the classroom. And then when they go outside for recess, they are staying with that same group the entire time. our specials, art, music, FIAD, they're delivering that instruction in the classroom to those students.
And so the teachers would rotate out for those specials, but the students would stay together throughout the day?
Correct.
Are classroom sizes smaller, or did you keep those about the same?
Well, we started with keeping them about the same, just to see how many were going virtual or in person. So they're slightly smaller because of those that have opted to go a virtual option. I do have a third grade classroom that would have typically had 27 students in each section, and we did break that into a third section with an additional teacher, so it was more manageable. But overall, the classroom sizes vary anywhere between 14 to 17 students.
And I understand about 24 families have opted to continue with virtual learning. How are you approaching that?
So we are still in the process of determining what that is going to look like exactly. Those students that have opted to go that route will be on a traditional calendar schedule, which won't start until September 1st with the rest of the district. So we are using a platform through RVA, Rural Virtual Academy, that we're going to use. And we will be looking to hire a teacher that will deliver that instruction with the students. So it's going to be, the expectation will be that they participate in the morning with their music with their math and reading like they would with typical instruction. They would have a break during a lunch recess period. And then the afternoon time would consist of social studies or science or an elective that they would of their choosing.
How are you approaching the cleaning of classrooms and the environment of keeping the spaces as germ-free as possible?
Sure. So our normal cleaning procedures each night, I've learned more about what disinfecting and sanitizing means than I ever thought I would. So the normal cleaning procedure in the evening is for them to disinfect. Our custodial staff go through and disinfect the room using the same supplies they have for years. The cleaning throughout the day, we're providing soap and water for staff just to wash down after the meal times in those hot spots. We also have some peroxide wipes and Clorox wipes that they're able to use during those times. And for this period right now, we do have a custodian that is on staff during the day that is going through and wiping down doors, wiping down the bathrooms, and cleaning them on a more regular schedule.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Nikki Pope, principal of Lemon Weir Elementary School in Toma. The school reopened last week, and you can join in with your questions. How comfortable are you with sending your child back to school this fall? What concerns do you have? Are you planning on sending them to a school in a mask? Join in with your questions, 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Nikki, I'm wondering how the teachers are doing, because we're hearing how teachers' unions are pushing back to have schools go virtual this fall. Are you getting pressure from your union to do remote learning instead?
Our union presidents, we have co-presidents, and she happens to be a first grade teacher within my building. And we also have another union member that is a teacher here as well. You know, they really just want to do what's best for students, and we believe that having them in a brick-and-mortar setting and teaching them is what is in their best interest. So we're taking in staff concerns. Of course, they have their own concerns when it comes to, you know, either passing the virus or contracting the virus. So we're listening to their concerns, and we're trying to adjust practices and be responsive to what they're asking us to do.
Before you have kids enter the building, are temperatures taken? How do you approach that each day with the health of the student?
We are not taking temperatures when they come in. There was a lot of conversation that took place in regards to that, and just the best practice or use of using the temperatures. So right now, if a student is displaying that they're not feeling well in the classroom, or they're saying that they have a headache, or a teacher just notices that they're not acting themselves, we're handling it like we typically would have. We're sending them to the office. The office will take the temperature at that time. If they have a temperature, we're putting them in a location, asking them to wear a mask at that time, and contacting their parents to let them move forward.
Has that happened yet since you reopened last Wednesday?
We've had several staff that just set a precaution. You know, a student is coughing or saying they're not feeling well, I have sent them to the office. Those students that, you know, did not have a fever, we did let the parents know just so they could stay or make a decision based on their end. But we, as far as having a fever, we haven't experienced that yet.
You know, your district covers hundreds of miles. The district says, as far as bus transportation, that it's really not possible for only one child to sit in a seat on a school bus. How are you managing transportation?
So that was one of the messages we sent to our families, was that if they wanted their child to participate in our transportation system, that we were not going to be able to socially distance them. And that was their choice if they were participating with that. So what we have done is we've created assigned seating for the students. We have determined that based on when they get dropped off in the morning or in the afternoon, routes, so they're not passing other students when they're getting off the bus. And then we're keeping families together as well. So siblings are sitting in the same seats. If there is room to spread out, we are obviously trying to do that. And we are encouraging masks. So when they get on, we're asking them if they have a mask or if they need their mask. And we've also, we used to have a shuttle point in the middle of our town where the middle school is, where we would transfer students to that location and they would then get out and go into a different bus that was a little bit easier for routing. And we have changed that routing system where the students that get on the bus will stay on that bus all the way home. So logistically, it's caused a little bit more for us to figure out timing and how long it's going to take. And obviously, our routes are a little longer to try to minimize their exposure to other students.
Joe and Madison called in, couldn't stay with us, but was wondering if you were testing your teachers and staff for the virus.
We are not. We are not testing them. If they choose to get tested, that is fine. You know, one of the comments that we've had back with staff in regards to that is the test is as good as that day. So had I required them to be tested prior to coming in, you know, and 2 days passed, we wouldn't know that it was still as valid as when they were tested. So we are not requiring them to test right now.
We're talking with Nikki Pope, principal of Lemon Weir Elementary School in Toma. The school runs on a year-round schedule, and it reopened for classroom instruction last week. Parents and caregivers, do you feel comfortable sending your child back to the classroom? What concerns do you have? Teachers, let's hear from you. What grade do you teach? What are your thoughts on returning to the classroom amid COVID? Join in at 800-642-1234. We will be back in a minute with Nikki Pope right here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're talking about the effort to re-enter school buildings and what it's like to be a school with in-person classes underway. Experts warn of the learning loss, the so-called COVID slide, and that the most vulnerable students will be left behind. We have Principal Nikki Pope, who's with us. Her elementary school in Toma reopened nearly a week ago. Let's take another call now. Matt is with us from Viroqua. Hi, Matt.
Hi. So there's lots of places all over the world that are sending kids back to school right now, but most of those countries seem to have gotten the COVID outbreaks under control. I just saw this morning when I was looking at my phone, listening to the show, headline in the La Crosse newspaper, Toma School District reports potential case of COVID-19 apparently at this school. And your principal said that only 20% of kids were wearing masks. And I'm just wondering, why is the school district not requiring every kid to wear a mask? It's almost like herd immunity and vaccinations. If one out of five kids are wearing those masks, they aren't going to do much good at all. So why can't the school, if you're choosing to have in-person classes, mandate the use of masks?
Matt, thank you for that. And Nikki, number one, please address the suspected positive case for COVID-19 and then the mask issue as well.
Sure. So firstly, we did have a situation where a student was exposed to someone that had tested positive and had displayed symptoms. So they were asked to go in and be tested from the health department. From those measures, we took the guidance from the Monroe County Health Department and asked any children that were within their proximity to quarantine. The health department actually took the lead and contacted those families. In regards to the use of masks, we listened to our families who overwhelmingly were contacting us, asking us not to require masks for their children. I'm not to say that at some time we won't get to the point where masks are required. At this point, from what the health department has shared with us, it wouldn't have changed whether those students were quarantined or not. The idea was to mitigate exposure.
So the children who are quarantining, but what about that teacher who was in that classroom?
So those teachers are teaching virtually right now. So they will be teaching from home into their classrooms. And then we'll have until results come back or we decide how that best practice is to move forward for them.
And how long will that last?
Depending on the results that come back, if it continues that the quarantine is that 14-day period, then that would be the expectation. We would, follow what the health department is asking us to do. And if not, then they would be back in front of their classrooms.
Let's bring in Beth now, joining us from Pewaukee. Hi, Beth.
Hi. First of all, thank you for all the work that you're doing around opening your school. I know it's not an easy task by any means, so we all appreciate your efforts and for coming and talking to us all. I just have a question around temperature checks. Are you doing temperature checks at school, or are our families doing them at home?
We are not doing temperature checks at school. Any of those well-being or healthy children checks we're encouraging families to do, especially if they don't feel like their child is feeling very well, not to send them to school if they have those suspicions, but we are not requiring a temperature check at school.
Beth, thank you for the call. Amanda now in Milwaukee. Hi, Amanda. Are you there, Amanda? Nope. Okay. How about Rita in Green Bay? Good morning, Rita.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I just want to appreciate the struggle that this school has had to wrestle to get children back into school. Thank you. It is a tough time, but I appreciate your ability to move forward, to make the tough decisions. Children need their teachers, and teachers need their children. I have friends who are teachers. And I'm a grandma, and I know how much my grandson yearns to get back to school with their buddies. Thank you.
Yeah, Rita, thank you. And Nikki, do you hear echoes of that as you talk with parents, in terms of trying to reopen and have the kids in the classroom?
Absolutely. I know that you mentioned earlier about the academic slide to this, but even more so our concern is their social and emotional well-being. And how our students are handling this. You know, I have four children that are in this building myself, and I witnessed their struggle and their longing to be with their friends and needing to get back to some sort of normalcy where we were addressing their, again, their social and emotional, being able to have those interactions and what that impact is going to have on them.
You are a year-round school schedule. How are you approaching the learning loss? Your students aren't away from the classroom as much, but when was the last time they were in engaged instruction?
The last time would have been the second week in March.
Okay.
Because we were actually in intercession when the shutdown happened. So it would have been the second week in March, and we are just starting with our progress monitoring right now. To just get a handle on where our students are at coming into us, and then really just making the adjustments from there, meeting them where they're at.
We're talking with Nikki Pope, principal of Lemonweir Elementary School in Toma. The year-round school reopened last week for in-person instruction. You can join in with your questions at 800-642-1234. Nikki, as you assess where students are at, where are they at emotionally? Because we've heard that there's going to be quite a bit of trauma as schools, as students reenter the classroom. They're very scared of the coronavirus.
I haven't really noticed them being scared of coming in. I would say they're very eager to be here. They're excited. You know, there were a lot of changes that were put into place. We're not letting them use the playground equipment, for example. They have to come in different entrances based on their transportation needs, and they have done an excellent job adjusting to those changes. You know, they've been very responsive to doing it because of they know that COVID-19 is there. The conversations are taking place within their classrooms, and what the virus is doing to our society, I guess, and the changes that need to be made in order to keep each other safe. They're being very responsive and respectful when being asked to do things differently, more frequently of washing hands, again, eating within the classroom. So we do have staff that are available. Our guidance counselor is taking extra steps to be prepared to talk to students if they are scared. But I really think that providing choice for our families, if we had a student that was really fearful to attend, their parents would have addressed that and provided another alternative for them, like our virtual option. So keeping in mind that we are a district that is looking to provide choice has been very helpful in order for us to address those needs.
Nikki, where is your tipping point? And by I mean by that is if you get a bunch of test results that come back positive this week, what will you do about the school?
That's a great question. we truly are figuring it out as we're going and waiting to see what the response is. If it gets to a point where it's not manageable for us to be able to have in-person instruction, or our families are telling us that that's not the route that they would like to take anymore, then we will have to reassess to see how we are going to deliver instruction across all of our elementaries, not just in this building.
Do you feel like your school is equipped to turn on a dime here? You may not even have time to poll your parents.
Right. The benefit of what happened this spring was that we were forced to turn on a dime. You know, we were a district that adjusted immediately to provide the needs for our students and provide instruction. So even more so now, we have really hit professional development early on with my staff with instruction on how they would use Microsoft Teams to deliver instruction virtually if that were to happen. All of our students are equipped with one-on-one devices at this time. So if that situation were to come up, I feel that we are more prepared now than we were in the spring. Certainly it'll be an adjustment and would be difficult to do, but I think that we would be ready to take on the challenge.
Nikki, thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you for asking. It's definitely an interesting time, but we really believe that we have an obligation to educate our children, and we're doing the best that we can to move forward.
Nikki Pope is principal of Lemonweir Elementary School in Toma. The school runs year-round and reopened last week. Just ahead, we're 15 weeks away from the November general election, but in the 2016 presidential election, millions of Americans did not vote. We'll learn why. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.